Okay, I'm just winging it up here. Dennis says you're gonna get caught. You get into too much stuff and you just ad lib. Okay, we're ad libbing and we're winging it.
Don't let me hold you.
Okay, now I want to show you something very interesting. These are the things that require meditation and study. These things don't pop out at you on the first or 30th or 40th reading. Okay. This person that I'm quoting here from all this nonsense, he says, you know, well, there's those that say that Genesis 1:1 and 2, you know, that happened ages before 3. They call it the gap theory. No, actually, the gap theory is not that. But the fact of the matter is, there is a large period of time between verses 1, 2 and verses 3. Okay? So, when this person quotes, makes this statement here that you know, Moses informs us that the heavens were created the exact time of the earth. And then he tells us in Exodus 20, for in 6 days God, the Lord made heavens and the earth. See, it's all the same thing. So, the heavens and earth were made in the 6 days. At least in a portion of one of the 6 days, that the heavens and the earth was created in a portion of those 6 days. Because he tells us in Exodus, for in 6 days God made the heavens and the earth. Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And if he made it in 6 days, then it's got to be in one of those 6 days. Well, I just showed you, but the word is not create and create. It's create and make, or created and made. Basa and bara and asa. Everything was created from which he was then going to make. The raw materials, if you will. And then we read in the last verse, verse 31, of all that God created for making. What he barad for asa. You see? He created for making. So he did not create the heavens and the earth in 6 days. In 6 days, he made the heavens and the earth as they now are from what he had already created millions or billions of years earlier in verse 1. Now let me give you another very unique proof to what was created and what wasn't created in these six periods called yoms. I'm going to take this from my notes rather than from the Bible. Okay, Genesis 1:20. It says, I'll go there in your Bible. It says, and God said, okay? We've got to go a little further. Genesis 1:24. Okay? And God said, let the earth bring forth the living, the che, consisting of the cattle and so on. And God said, you notice how he starts that off? Every time he's going to make something from what he had already created, it says, and God said, here's what I'm going to do. He always starts it that way. Here's what I'm going to do. You can say it that way. And God said, here's what I'm going to do. Okay? When did that period that he's now talking about doing something, when did it start? Well, you back up to one verse, to verse 23, it says, and the evening and the morning were the fifth day. And God said, okay? And then we go into the creation of the sixth day. So what begins the sixth day? It's between, and the evening and the morning were the fifth day. That's where it starts. And God said, let it happen. That is the sixth day. Now, keep backing up. Verse 20. And God said, let the waters spring abundantly, and all of that. After what? I screwed up a little bit. I'm sorry. Okay, let me get this straight. I'm going to go to Genesis 1:31. I knew I was doing this. My mind's saying, Ray, you're not doing this right. So why? What am I not doing right? I'm not doing it right. Now I'm going to get it right. Okay, here's the end of the six creation yoms, or creation time. The very last verse of chapter 1 of the first chapter of the Bible. And how does it end? It ends with, and the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Right? What began the sixth day? Verse 24. And God said. So between what God said and the evening and the morning, that was the sixth day. There's nothing that happened in the sixth day before verse 24, and nothing that happened after verse 31. It's got to be between there. The sixth day ended with the evening and the morning. That ends it. That is the sixth day. When did it begin? When God said in verse 24. Now we're getting it. Now, verse 23. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. That's the end of the fifth day, or the fifth yom, the fifth period of time. When did that fifth day of making begin? Verse 20. And God said. Simple? There's a pattern here. We're talking Scripture. Verse 19. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. This is the end of the fourth day. When did it begin? Verse 14, and God said. Verse 13, and the evening and the morning were the third day. When did it begin? Verse 9, and God said. Verse 8, and the evening and the morning were the second day, which began when? Verse 6, and God said. And the evening and the morning were the first day, verse 5. The end of the first time. When did it begin?
3.
And God said, where is verse 1 and 2?
Before
the six days. Exactly, Renee. Bingo. It was there all the time. It was there all the time. The 6 days only consist of what God said should take place during those periods of time. But in the beginning, God had already created the heavens and the earth. The creation was finished from the foundation of the world. And in verse 2, the earth was uninhabitable, in tohu and bohu, uninhabitable for humanity. It had to be fashioned. And he begins that fashioning when God said. Verse 1 and 2 have nothing to do with the six creative times. Totally outside of that period. Can you see it?
Got it.
Okay. I might as well take this off. It keeps falling off.
Hey, Ray.
Yes.
Change this. What Renee had on her Bible.
Shows in the beginning, and then after that, it says the 6 days of creation.
Yes, yeah, some have. Does mine have something like that? I don't think it does.
But,
I saw that. Sometimes those headings are inspired. Yeah. So anyway, I'll continue on with some more of this yom, you know, the meaning of a yom. Oh yeah, this person says this too. Young Earth creationists say, whenever yom is used with an ordinal or cardinal number, like first, second, one, two, and so forth, that it always represents a 24-hour day. Always. Not true. Let's turn to Zechariah. Zechariah 14, let's begin here about verse 8. And it shall come to pass in that day, okay, that day, which is referring to some period of time, I would reckon, you know, like the great day of the Lord, or in that day, that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day. Same words used in Genesis 1.
Verse 7.
But it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at eventime it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that the living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. Summer and winter, in a whole seasons, that day. One day. So much for that unscriptural nonsense. What?
It's going to be one busy day.
So no, there's a cardinal ordinal number. One day, and it's going to be for seasons. That one day. Had God meant evening and morning to mean day and night without even using the words day and night, he could have said, you know, he could have used the sunsets or something, you know, from sunset to sunset was the second day or the third day and so on. But he uses this evening and morning, and this has more profound meaning. Remember we read in this paper, this heretic said, nowhere else in the Bible do we find this evening and morning. You know, it's only here, and it must represent a 24-hour solar period of time. Nowhere in the Bible is this used. Actually, there are three times. I'll show you one. Turn to Psalm 90. Psalm Let me begin the beginning. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations before the mountains were brought forth, or even thou hast formed the earth and the world, even the everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. You turn man to destruction and says, return, you children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight as is yesterday. It's interesting. It's one little couple verses that brings in the creation, the heavens, the earth. 1,000 years is a day and so on. It's all in there. For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past and a watch in the night. You carry them away as with a flood. They are as a sleep in the morning. They are like grass which groweth up, and in the evening it fadeth away. I mean, flourishes and groweth up, and in the evening it is cut down and withered. What do we have here? What? Oh, Psalm 90. Oh, no, Psalm 90. I'm sorry. Psalm 90. Okay, catch up. Psalm 90, verse 4. For 1,000 years in your sight is but yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. You carry them away as a flood. They are as a sleep. In the morning they are like grass which grows up. See? This is what it's telling us in Genesis. Morning signifies order, light, birth, growth, progress. Night, things get dark, gloomy. They become fuzzy. You can't see them anymore. It's chaos to cosmos. And here he uses evening and morning exactly in that context. In the morning, they are like grass. Okay? But in the evening, they are cut down. The morning is positive, growth, life. The evening is cut down, darkness, death. What do we know where in the Bible are these words used? Except, you just read it, didn't you? Did it mean sunset? That a person, sunrise, he's born at sunrise and he dies at sunset. Well, yeah, it could be used that way, but it would represent his whole life, not 24 hours. You see? So here you see the symbolism of evening and morning portrayed perfectly. One has to do with progress and order and light and life, and the other has with darkness and death. So we do have an example of what these words mean, don't we? Okay. So, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as they say. You say, well, can these days, these periods, these yoms, these times of making, can they be long periods of time? Of course. We have example after example in the Scripture. It can be anywhere from hours to days to weeks, years, or aeons, ages. But what is the proof of the pudding? The proof of the pudding is when we examine the universe, that's what they show. That these were long periods of time. And no, verse 1 and 2 are not part of the first day of refashioning the creation. They are not. We went through that. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And God said, started that day. The first day, not the first day, day one was started when God said, not when in the beginning God had already created the heavens and the earth. Okay? You got that all clear? I mean, that's one thing you should learn from this conference and really let it stick. Verse 1 and 2 are outside of the 6 days of fashioning the earth. Exodus is, in the King James, it is wrong where it says, for in 6 days. The word in is not there. They made it up. They stuck it in there. For 6 days, he asah the heavens and the earth. Asah is making. Bara is creating. He had already created them in verse 1. Now, for 6 whole days, he is asahing them into the fashion that he wants them to be. Okay? All right. Here's one. Whoops, I'm sorry. All right, I want to expand more upon this evening and morning, as we just read in Psalm 90, having a much more profound meaning than sunset and sunrise, okay? It has to do with bringing order out of chaos, or we say cosmos. Cosmos means orderly. The cosmos is the orderly creation of the universe. Now, when we look at the science of the universe, we're going to see something about this evening and morning business. Right out here in the open, right out here in the creation. Listen. Romans 1. You know, people like this person who wrote me this thing, you know, maybe someday you'll believe Exodus, right? You know, they parrot all these right words and all the right phrases and all the scriptures, but where the tire meets the road, they don't believe a word of it. They deny it all. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness and unrighteousness of men, not all humanity, but all men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. That is not the elect, by the way. Okay. If you are holding the truths of God in unrighteousness, you are not one of God's elect. Because that which may be known of God is manifested to them or among them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Why then do we deny everything that is made? And say, well, yeah, I know it looks like this, and all the laws would have it be that way, and yeah, my stupid argument contradicts those laws, but I believe that, you know, the Grand Canyon was formed in 1 year. Such nonsense. Listen, Jesus Christ said, thy word is truth. And he says, the invisible things from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Now that's true. That's a true statement. If you can't see these things, then they're not being clearly understood or clearly seen by you. (Clears throat) When I look at the Grand Canyon and I see 6,000 feet of water-laid strata, and then try to convince me at the end of a barrel of a 357 Magnum that a flood laid every one of those layers down, one after the other, in a violent, turbulent flood that has ripped up the whole crust of the earth 3 to 5 miles deep, and now is laying it down in these beautiful patterns where you can see one row after another. It's just total nonsense. Maybe we'll have time to cover that a little of that in the morning, I don't know. And then scientists look at the things that are made. The Grand Canyon is made. It's something that is made. It's there to see. You know? God decided one place on this earth, I'm going to dig a big trench right through the middle of the strata, a mile deep, and everybody can come from around the world and they can see what's down there. What's in the next layer and the next layer? How deep are they? 600 feet of sandstone. You know, so many hundred feet of shale. So many hundred feet of the, you know, all the way down, a mile deep. What's down there? Granite. And what they call basement rock. Now, as if it was all laid down in the flood. Is that what you see? You think there was a worldwide flood that killed everything, and that's what you're seeing down there? Where are the dead animals? Where are the bones? Where are the fossils? 6,000 feet of water-laid strata. There's not one mouse down there. Not one rat. Not one snake. Not one fish. Higher up, there's a few fish teeth. Not one dinosaur. Despite that these lying turkeys put up a wall in a museum, say it represents the Grand Canyon, and then stick dinosaur bones in the side. Lying, deceitful frauds. Why do they do that? Because they have nothing. They make it up. They lie. They fabricate. They fraud. They despise the Word of God. They despise this verse here. Don't tell me you love God and you love the Word of God and you despise everything it says and you despise everything it shows you. I don't mean you. I know you people are with me. I'm talking about, you know, those that be. So, this statement is true as Jesus' words when he said, "Thy word is truth." This is truth. The rocks out there do not lie. Those rocks I picked up yesterday are unlike any rocks I've ever seen on a hilltop or a mountaintop. I mean, they just look like pulverized mush made into different things. And then, of course, there's some quartz in there and so on. But that thing was caused by a meteorite, a big rock from outer space. Just pulverized. That thing came in at 40,000 miles an hour. That's 3 times faster than a high-powered rifle. That's fast. And when you consider that was a quarter of a mile in diameter. A rock. One rock. A quarter of a mile in diameter. Hitting Wetumpka, Alabama at 40,000 miles an hour. You saw what happened to the jet that crashed in Pennsylvania. It was doing 590 miles an hour. Where is the plane? There is no plane. That poor woman pilot that was flying that passenger jet over the Everglades when those oxygen canisters caught fire. Put her in a straight dive into the Everglades. Where is that plane? They never found it. 500 and some miles an hour. We're talking about, and that was paper thin, almost aluminum. 500 miles an hour. Now imagine solid rock. Oh, quarter of a mile in diameter. and not hitting at 500 miles an hour, 40,000 miles an hour. I mean, it created its own little mountain chain over there. That's power. And tomorrow, we're going to talk some more about that power. I'll give you your handouts, I promise. Okay. I'm going to read you a couple pages from Dr. Schroeder's book, Gerald Schroeder. This is Genesis and the Big Bang, the discovery of harmony between modern science and the Bible. And he has a small chapter in here called Evening and Morning, Taking Order Out of Chaos. Genesis 1:31 says, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." Remember I said this morning that Angelos translated Genesis 1:1, "In wisdom God created the heaven and the earth." I'll talk about that tomorrow. Well, Angelos had his own translation on this too. Rather than saying, "And everything that he made, God saw everything, and behold, it was very good," here's what he translates it. This is marvelous. This is a man 1850 years ago translated this verse. And he knew something. He didn't just make this up. "And God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was a unified order." Well, what was it before? Chaos. Remember I showed you that chart of the lakes and the rivers and the mountains and everything? The earth, you know, there's, the earth makes all those things. The beginning was chaos, covered with water. With only slight variations in the wording, the phrase of each of the 6 days of creation is marked by the phrase, "And there was evening and there was morning." Commentaries on the opening verses of Genesis have wondered at the occurrence of the evening and morning sequence and the stated passage of each day, in quotes. This is especially true of the first few days of Genesis, when even in accord with the literal reading of the text, there was neither earth, neither sun nor earth. Did you ever realize that before? In the beginning, God had already created the heavens and the earth. The heavens would have included the sun, and of course included the earth. But there was no earth like we understand it. And the word earth means ground anyway. And there was no ground. It was covered with water and chaos. And the sun wasn't shining. We get that on the fifth day. The sequence in which a day starts with the evening follows the biblical concept of a day. And then he talks about, like Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, they were to keep it from evening to evening. Because if you just say keep it a day, you keep it for the daylight portion of the day, and then instead of fasting all night too, they go out and binge. So God has to say. Maimonides summarized this thing about evening and morning by saying, "On the earth, both evening and morning are always present. There on the earth, at every moment, ever-changing places, where it is morning, and in the places opposite, it is evening." It's always evening and morning at the same time on the earth. At all times. Huh? This reveals quite an exact comprehension of the illumination of the sun's light on a spherical earth at a time in history when mankind, mostly in Western humanity, dreaded falling off the edge of the earth. Nehemiah understood this. The earth is a sphere, and that it is sunrise and sunset at the same time, always on the earth. It never goes away. I mean, you might say it turns around on its axis or whatever, but it's always there. It never leaves. It's always sunset, always evening, always sunrise, always. See? He had the sense to see that. The Hebrew for evening is erev. And this is the literal meaning of the word, evening. Although the root of erev carries with it implications far beyond that of a setting sun. What is the visual sensation of evening? Darkness begins, objects become obscure, blurred. The root of erev means just that, mixed up, stirred together, disorderly. The Hebrew for morning is boker. Its meaning is quite the opposite of erev. Morning brings the first light. Objects visually mingled by the dark of night become distinct entities. And this is the root meaning of boker. Discernible, able to be distinguished, orderly. Isn't it interesting? Jesus Christ was crucified and buried in the evening. I mean, he died and was buried in the evening. When did he rise? In the morning. Had the text said there was morning and there was evening, our concept of a day might have been better satisfied. But the sequence is a clue to it here. Always starts with evening. There is a systematic flow from disorder, chaos, or evening, to order, cosmos, or morning. To appreciate this rarity of flow of disorder to order, we must, at this point, acquire a fuller understanding of the laws of thermodynamics. Entropy. Chaos out of order. Not order out of chaos. The laws of thermodynamics that control the universe is bringing something that is orderly into disorder and chaos. Everywhere, always. Why would God do that? Why would He make something that by its very nature starts to fall apart, break down, become unuseful? There's a spiritual lesson here. The order that we see about us, the exquisite orchestration of inorganic chemicals and organic molecules into a symphony of life is misleading if we apply it to the universe as a whole. Those intricate and regular arrangements of matter that are characteristic of life stand in sharp contrast to the ever-increasing chaos of the universe. A chaos that at times is referred to as the impending heat death of the universe. For with each act, it is as simple as a sustained nuclear reaction or as complex as a parent tickling a giggling child. Some energy or some matter or both are transferred from an orderly state of potential usefulness to a random chaotic state from which useful work can never again be drawn. Isn't that amazing? This is what happens everywhere. Everywhere. The universe is breaking down. Hot things are getting colder. There are three laws of thermodynamics. And they are valid in every condition in the universe ever observed by scientists. The first law states that regardless of the reaction taking place within a closed system, the sum of the energy and mass of the system remains the same. Which you can change things, but you can't get rid of them or diminish them. You can burn a piece of wood and it'll become fire, heat, and smoke. But you still got fire, heat, and smoke, or at least you got heat or some smoke till it's dissipated into some other thing, but it's still there. It's just so thin you don't see it. But you have not totally destroyed it. When hot water is mixed with cold water in an insulated container, the hot gets cooler and the cool gets warmer. But the total heat remains the same. It does not change. The molecules of the hot water were moving rapidly and randomly within the liquid. The molecules of the cold water were also moving randomly, but more slowly. The speed of these molecular motions, the kinetic energy of the molecules, is what determines temperature of an object. Molecular motion is, in fact, what heat is. When these fast, hot molecules are mixed with the slow-moving molecules of the cold water, random collisions among the two groups soon distributed energy equally among them, and they were all eventually in moderate motion. The first law of thermodynamics provides the groundwork for what is the most relevant in our discussion. The simple way to remember the laws of thermodynamics is as follows. Then the first law states, you can't win. The second law states, you can't get out. The first law says you can't win. The second law says you can't break even. And the third law says you can't get out of the game. Having mixed a cup of hot water with the cold water, there's no way we can separate the now lukewarm molecules back into two separate groups, everyone hot and everyone cold, without the expenditure of more energy. With every action, chemical, physical, or nuclear as well, there's a decrease in the amount of energy or usefulness for future work. Within the myriad of stars of the universe, mass is being propelled out at radiant energy. The sum of the mass plus the energy of the universe remains unchanged. That is the first law of thermodynamics. But the cosmic potential to produce useful energy in the form of high temperature heat is ever diminishing. And it's heading toward what we call the ultimate frigid temperature of minus 270 degrees centigrade. That's where all motion stops. There's no motion, there's no heat. There's no heat, there's no motion, and all molecules stop. What? I don't know. I don't think about that. The flow of heat from hot to cold is what provides the basis for work. And yet, within a limited portion of the universe, all this going on everywhere in the universe, in the stars and in the planets and in the earth and on the earth and under the earth and everywhere else. And yet, within a limited portion of the universe, highly ordered structures have appeared. We humans are the most extreme example of such localized order. Our life systems, or even those of the most simple single-celled bacteria or algae, are so vastly complex that one might question the validity of the second law of thermodynamics. Only when we view life processes in context with environment, our environment, does the overall increase in entropy become apparent. Okay, then he talks about how, you know, our body temperature is 98 degrees. Yet if we're put in a room at 98 degrees, you say we ought to be perfectly at home. We're hot. So the body, you know, comes up with a way to create entropy, you know, to cool it down. You know, you perspire, it evaporates, and it cools your body down. Now comes a major physio-philosophical question. If the universe trend is toward chaos, why is there order at all? If the basic laws of physics dictate that orderly things slow down, get colder, deteriorate, go from order to chaos, why is there order anywhere in the universe? It seems to defy the laws of thermodynamics, which work on everything, always, everywhere. The ordered complexity of life is clearly extraordinary. The human universe might have remained a mass of randomly moving electrons, protons, assorted subatomic particles present at that first speck of time referred to as in the beginning. If such were the case, we would not be here to wonder about it. or an overriding purpose of this flow of the universe from its state of the Big Bang to the form we observe today. The author of Genesis thought this flow toward order was sufficiently important and exceptional to emphasize it by the regular repetition, and there was evening and there was morning, because everything else in science and the universe goes the other way. But God is making this go contrary to that. Life is different. Life is special. The compartmentalization of the events of our Genesis into days bracketed by Erev and Boker, evening and morning, is convenient for talking in the language of man, but the root meanings of the words hold the secrets. You know, there's a proverb. I don't know exactly how it goes. It's not like the words of God are like apples of gold in a silver vessel. Okay? But
platters
or whatever of silver. What does that mean? Okay. Well, I mean, I agree, and some Kabbalists say what that means is the Word of God, okay, are like golden apples in a silver bowl. The silver bowl is what you read, what you see, what you observe in the literal sense. That's the silver. But his real words are not the silver. The real words, the deep meaning behind all of that, those are the apples of gold inside the silver bowl. So inside the text of this Bible, the words, the silver words, there are apples of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Apples of gold. You'll never learn it from heretics like this, though. Okay. Well, we got a little longer we go yet. In the beginning, there was turmoil, a cosmic soup of highly concentrated energy and matter all mixed together. There was neither heavy elements ready to release the heat of the radioactive decay nor energetic chemical complexes available to power the process of life. The temperature was 10 to the 30 to the power of 32 Kelvin. Kelvin is a measurement of temperature where zero is absolute zero. 349 degrees below zero, whatever. That was where all matter stops. Nothing moves anymore. With the expansion of the universe, the energy concentration fell. Temperatures dropped drastically. As we have learned, the average photon temperature today is a mere 3.5 degrees Kelvin. Entropy increased throughout the volume of the universe, but the increase was not uniformly distributed. At many places within the increasing volume of the universe, local order was imposed on matter by those basic properties instilled within all matter at the creation, the nuclear, electromagnetic, and gravitational forces. Matter started to join with matter. Light and matter became distinct. Okay? In the beginning, God had created the heavens and the earth, and then down the road, he said, now let there be light. The light had to come out of this matter, which was slowing down and growing colder. The converging flow of matter toward local centers of concentrations produces high velocities and eventually high pressures. As the matter crashes toward a local center, both the velocity and pressure become pressed together as heat. Temperatures in the core rise. At approximately a million degrees Kelvin, the velocity of nucleus becomes sufficiently high to cause nuclear fission. On collision with the nuclei, hydrogen converts to helium, helium to heavier elements. In the process, fusion in the process of fusion, some of the mass converts to pure energy. A nuclear furnace has ignited. A star has been born. Notice Genesis 1. In the beginning, God had created. In the beginning, God had created the heavens and the earth. Verse 15, and He made the stars also. He created the heavens back in verse 1. Verse 5, it says, He made the stars also. He made them out of what He created. The Big Bang puts its energy into spreading matter. Gravity helps recover part of the energy by forming second and third generation hot spots, which we call stars. Life processes derive their power from this recycling of energy and matter. The biblical text describes this localized progression from less order to more order as a flow from evening to morning, or more accurately, from Erev to Boker. Hundreds of years before the appearance of the Greek language, before the word chaos and cosmos were ever written, the step-by-step progression towards the orderly world described by the subtle language and evening and morning. And this is an ancient text that confirms this interpretation. It is Ungelos who translates, you know, in verse, I showed you that already, where, you know, everything was very good. He says everything was a orderly, a unified order. Everything was a unified order. At that point, it was a unified order. What was it before? It's chaos. Every creative period went from chaos to order, chaos to order, chaos to order, till finally, at the end of the sixth period, everything was a unified order. That's how God get rid of the chaos. God uses a process. Why does He use that process? Why does He do a lot of things? God does strange. Oops. God does strange things. Ungelos perceived that a qualitative change in the nature of the universe had occurred, a change from disorder without the possibility of life to order with life. Okay? There's a lot in that first chapter of Genesis. There's a lot in there. Okay? Okay. Well, that's a natural breaking point where I finished that section of Dr. Schroeder's book, and that'll put us in a position to start in another area. It'll be along these same lines. We're still going to be talking about the yomes and everything else, but we're going to get into a couple other interesting things. Theories that supposedly are scriptural that show that the earth was made very quickly in a short period of time, not very long ago. Okay.